Hi, thanks for listening. You know, if you've been a wine enthusiast for 10, 20 years or so, it's very likely you've had a Rombauer Vineyards Chardonnay. It's one of the top-selling wines in restaurants and has been consistently since the early 2000s. Now, that kind of success deserves some attention. So today on The Wine Road, our venture takes us to Rombauer Vineyards. Aside from their popular Chardonnay, Rombauer Vineyards crafts some other expressive varieties such as Sauvignon Blanc, Zinfandel, Merlot, and Cabernet Sauvignon, of course. I mean, they are in Napa Valley. And their dessert wines are heavenly. In early May, I was invited to attend a luncheon, a tour, and tasting at Rombauer Vineyards, which is located just outside St. Helena. I was anxious to do so because they were still one of the higher-profile, successful wineries I had yet to visit. While there, I had an opportunity to talk with K.R. Rombauer, a second-generation family member, and their talented Australian winemaker, Richie Allen. Patriarch Kerner Rombauer wasn't there that day, so we used his office for the interview. And then, unexpectedly, Kerner passed away just 1 week later, at the age of 83. I'll touch upon that later in the interview. But for now, let's start at the beginning, when Kerner and Joan Rombauer moved to Napa Valley in 1972, but the wine business was not the reason.
They wanted to raise my sister and I in a rural agricultural environment, which they had enjoyed growing up in Southern California in Escondido, about 45 minutes east of San Diego. And that drew them to a location that they felt would, you know, recreate that for my sister and I.
But by 1976, they became friends with a lot of people in the wine business and ended up becoming partners in Conn Creek Winery. And they jumped in wholeheartedly, didn't they?
Well, they had a lot of encouragement. I don't know if their other friends just wanted them to experience some of the pain they were going through. But, you know, it's a tremendous amount of hard work, a lot of detail. It is a labor of love for certain. And my dad was an airline pilot and mandatory retirement was at age 60. So he was looking for something else to do, his next career, and had a lot of friends that were in the wine business, winemakers, grape growers, and one thing led to another, and we got into the wine business.
How old are you at that time?
Wow. I would have been around 14.
And interestingly, by the early 80s, they were working with iconic names in the business, sourcing Cabernet from Stag's Leap Wine District. Your mother started working at Stag's Leap Winery. And once the Rombauer Winery and Custom Crush facility was completed, they were working with wineries like Dominus and Spotswood, Duckhorn, Corison, Etude, and helping them produce some of their early wines. So, boy, what an early history they had with folks that they experienced.
It was a magical time. Obviously, Phil Baxter, who was up at Rutherford Hill Winery when we had sold our partnership at Conn Creek Winery, said, "Hey, you know, if you're going to start your own winery, you ought to consider custom crushing. We're now at a point where we're taking over the extra capacity that we once had, and you might want to consider that as a way to build a facility larger than you need and grow into it over a period of many years.
And make money along the way."
Well, it's like having partners without having partners. They help you pay for the building and the equipment, and you need it, and they need it, so it's everybody wins. So it's a great structure to work with. And then we were just fortunate enough to work with some really fantastic people and wineries along the way.
Which are now some very impressive wineries.
Yes. Yeah. No. It was a great journey for us, and hopefully helpful for those folks as they were developing their own facilities. And it's not uncommon that somebody gets in the wine business, and they don't have some place to make it, but they can have their own fruit and their winemaking team at a location where it can be crushed, fermented, barrel-aged, and then quite possibly bottled. And over, you know, maybe a period of 3 to 5 years prior to them building their own facility.
I'm talking with K.R. Rombauer. And following a small bottling in 1981, 1982 saw the first larger bottling of Rombauer Vineyards, which took place at Stag's Leap Wine Cellars.
So our first vintage 1980 Cabernet But that was a very small production, 400 cases, I think 800 cases in 1981, and then probably about maybe 1,400 cases in 1982 with the Cabernet. And then in 82, we started producing Chardonnay as well.
Yeah, the Chardonnay. We'll get to that in a moment. But the next lucrative era was about 88 when they started buying vineyards, which ends up with the estate Jones Vineyard Zinfandel, the vineyards in Carneros and Napa, and also in Sonoma, Atlas Peak, St. Helena, Calistoga, and even the Sierra foothills over that number of years. So it was business must have been good, allowing you to expand like that.
Well, you know, we certainly, I think my father and mother had a good sense of business, and then they took risks. But it was, you know, an educated risk on their part. And we were at a point where it made sense to start investing in vineyards to secure the raw product we needed to make the wines, the finished product.
And speaking of the Chardonnay, I was going to say, I guess the extreme popularity of the Rombauer Chardonnay helped finance some of that.
It, you know, it's been a wonderful program for us, a beautiful wine. We love it. Thankfully, our customers love it. And we're just trying to make sure we stay on course.
It's got an impressive track record because Top 100 Wines from Wine Spectator has referenced that wine many times. And it's been the top 10 Chardonnays on Wine and Spirits restaurant poll every year since 2004. And that's astounding. I'm happy to say that I've done some wine tasting for Wine and Spirits over the last couple of years. So I've certainly tasted that wine blindly at first. And I noticed this year it has placed number 3 on Wine and Spirits restaurant poll.
You know, I think our customers enjoy it. They ask for it. They thankfully they buy it and drink it at restaurants. So, you know, once again, we're just trying to make sure that we produce a beautiful, consistent style of Chardonnay year in and year out.
Your Cabernet is respected, but you talked earlier about your Merlot and how it's hard to get people to get back to Merlot, and yet Duckhorn, one of the initial wineries that your family helped, they scored the best wine of 2017 with their Merlot. So they've certainly kept a little bit of a spotlight on that variety.
Absolutely. The Duckhorn Three Palms Merlot, beautiful wine, wine of the year in 2017. I want to say that was the 2014 vintage,
2014,
perhaps.
3 Palms.
Gorgeous wine and beautiful sight. I mean, it gets us back to land and vineyards and the raw product that gives us the opportunity to make incredible finished wines. So, you know, we were just fortunate enough to have great relationships with so many people throughout the valley that were very helpful and very generous as we were learning how to make beautiful wines.
And then in 2008, this bearded Aussie shows up, and he hasn't left, has he?
Oh, boy. Richie Allen's just a tremendous addition to the team, and I think is, you know, taking us to new heights and is really a solid foundation for us.
Richie, it was good to talk to you earlier, and I guess when you showed up, you had some winemaking experience by that time.
Yeah, I mean, I came here in 2004 as a graduate winemaker on an intern program, thinking I would be here maybe 12 weeks. And that was in 2004. And I've left a few times, I'm not going to lie, but all roads have always led back to Rombauer and Kerr and his father. If I've been gone too long, they've called me up and said, hey, how do you get back here? Can we get you back here? And here I am, and I love it. It's a great place to work. Kerr and his family probably the most passionate family I've ever seen about wine. All they care about is making the best wine they can. And so I've never seen a business that will invest so heavily in equipment and vineyards to make better wine. And when you find that level of commitment from someone who wants to make it and you get to do it with them, it's not something you want to give up.
Yeah, you have a nice balance of modern technology, but also with some of the old world techniques.
Yeah, I mean, everything with wine tends to be an older technique. I don't think there's any real secrets in winemaking other than the better you can understand the technique and how it works, then you can learn how to apply it better. And so, you know, Rombauer, we kind of pride ourselves on being at the forefront of winemaking technology. And it's not that we're making wine by numbers. Everything's still done by taste. But we're constantly trying to work out how each technique works, why it works, and how we can apply it better in order to make better wine. And I've sort of come up with this theory when I took over in 08 that if we're not constantly trying to improve, we're falling behind. And the Rombauers have a pretty similar motto in that, just make it better. And it's been a great match for all of us. And, you know, I'm not going anywhere other than here. And I don't want to go anywhere else in here because no one else wants to do what they want to do. And I want to do the same.
I saw on the website, and you mentioned it earlier during our tasting, you're using some digital aerial photography. And that's very helpful, isn't it?
Yeah. We've been playing around with it since 2004. And we've learn how to get higher resolution from it and apply the data better. But some of the stuff we're doing now with cameras in the vineyard and application of technology in order to drive quality is at the cutting edge. And, you know, we're always trying to work out what's the perfectly balanced grapevine for that particular site. When I say that particular site, I mean where that vine is in the ground. If we can get a better balanced grapevine, it's going to produce a higher quality grape. And a higher quality grape means higher quality wine. And once we pick that grape, all we have to do is not mess it up. So if we can get a better grape from a single vine, we're going to do everything we can. So, you know, the NDVI technology we've been working with, I mean, it's pretty common now. Everybody's using it. Everyone applies it a little bit differently. But I'd say that's I'd love to tell you more about what we're doing in terms of vineyard technology, but a lot of it's pretty guarded at the moment. I'll put it that way.
You mentioned not to screw it up, and I was wondering, I was going to say a little bit later on that you're going to be fine here. You just don't want to screw up that Chardonnay, do you?
Oh, no. Well, we always joke, like, it's when you decide to pick a vineyard, it's almost like, I don't know, like bittersweet. Because when you decide to pick, in my mind, then I've given up on making better grapes from that vineyard for that year. And you're always trying to push a little bit further. And I have this, like, kind of like, not remorse, but like kind of like, well, that's the best I could do this year, and how many more years will I get? Because once you decide the pick, that's the most quality you'll ever have. And everything you do from a winemaking standpoint from then on is either going to keep that quality or lose it. And so we're all about making sure that every step of the way we don't compromise that quality. But picking a vineyard, it's, yeah, I don't know how to describe it. It's just like, oh, man, I've given up for this year. I've had to pick it, like, could it have been better if this had happened 2 months ago, or this had happened the week ago, or if we had done this? And, you know, it's the same like when we're replanting a vineyard. I hate replanting vineyards. Like, to me, that's like giving up on a generation. And, you know, I'll do anything I can to get a vineyard healthy and keep it healthy and keep its roots in the ground. And as long as it's producing high quality fruit and the quality's there, we try to do everything we can to keep those vineyards going, you know, as long as we can.
That's the interesting thing about the wine business is that I could say, well, you'll get another chance next year to do better. Yeah. But if you were in the beer industry, you'd be like, well, in another few weeks.
Yeah, it's when you were young. So I started, my interest in wine started when I was 19. And by the time I had gone through college and I was making wine in my early 20s, you kind of felt like, oh, it's all right, we'll have next year, And here I am, like, getting close to 40, turned 40 this year. I'm like, how many years do I have left? How many years do I have a chance to make good wine? And my wife always jokes because she's like, you've got plenty. You're never going to retire. I know what you're like. But I'm always trying to think, you know, will I get another year like 2013 or 2008? Like you remember certain vintages for different reasons, and every vintage is different. And how many more of those will you get? But then you look back on like years like 2011, which was an incredibly challenging year. But honestly, those are some of the wines I'm the most proud of, because we managed to take fruit that was somewhat average in quality and make incredible wines by not compromising anything any step of the way. And it was 2011 was a year that was incredibly technically challenging, whereas 2013 was a great vintage, but the wines were somewhat easier to make. So it's this, how many years do I have? I don't know. As many as I can get.
Richie, you know, I've talked with winemakers who are in their 80s and even 90s. So yeah. I'd say you're about halfway through.
Yeah, maybe. Well, yeah. I mean, you figure he's got at least 40 more years.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's
And you're going to see many years like 13 and many like 11, too.
I don't know. I honestly think every winemaker gets a vintage of his lifetime. And, you know, in Australia, they were like, some winemakers will talk about 98 or 99 as their vintage of their lifetime. And, you know, people talk about 71 in Australia and South Australia for Shiraz. And I always wonder, well, you know, was 2013 my year? Like, is that the vintage of my life? Will it ever get any better? And it's, that's what drives you forward. Like, you want to keep going, but you just want to make sure that you never, like, what if a great year came along and you were like, I'm too busy, and you messed it up. Like, that's my thing. I'm like in constant fear that I'll like squander that opportunity. And that's what drives you to keep going. And, you know, I'll wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go to work because I've got this fear that I'll squander the opportunity of making good wine. So,
hey, are you going to keep instilling that fear in him?
Yeah, it's self-imposed by him. That's what's so great about it. And, you know, prior to coming here to Rumbear, Richie, over a five-year period, got 10 harvests under his belt, working in the Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere. And so he's, you know, his own best enemy from a standpoint of just challenging himself and trying to do better and better. And, you know, I think in conjunction with our family, it's a perfect combination. And, you know, we're encouraged and challenged by other beautiful wines out there that wineries make. And, you know, we're in awe of what our competition does, and it pushes us to hopefully do better each year.
You brought that up a couple of times today, so you certainly appreciate looking at what others are doing and learning from that.
You know, if you don't drink other people's wines and experience other people's what they're doing, you know, why they're doing what they're doing, you're never going to get better. And I think collectively that's, you know, a mentality that we have here at Rumbear Vineyards. And we all, you know, push each other along and challenge each other.
And moving along, you and your sister are now, you're the second generation. And Shiana?
My sister Shauna Rumbauer. Yes, we grew up in the business together. My mom and dad, of course, started it. And so it's been a great journey so far. And we have a tremendous team of people that help us, you know, put this all together and create these beautiful wines. And so it's very, very special for us.
I understand now a third generation has come along.
Yes, there's a total of five grandchildren. My sister's oldest daughter, Reagan Blackwood, is involved in sales and marketing and just seems to have a real natural affinity for it, enjoys it, and loves wine. And so we're hopeful that the other, you know, four grandchildren will find some interest in it, and we'll just see where it goes.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, Kerner Rumbauer passed away just a week after I spoke with KR and Richie. I thought I'd pass on some background on this successful, beloved man. In his younger years, he served in the California Air National Guard as a pilot from 1956 to 1965, beginning his lifelong love of flying. Then they moved from Escondido to Texas, where he began his commercial airline pilot career, flying for Braniff International Airways. Remember Braniff? Aside from being gracious and hospitable, Kerner was also known as a generous philanthropist. Sadly, he lost his wife, Joan, in 2002 to pancreatic cancer, and that inspired Kerner to start the Rumbauer Pancreatic Cancer Research Fund at University of California, San Francisco. The Rumbauer family has continued to be involved in fighting cancer, and in 2010 established a $4 million endowment, the Joan Rumbauer UCSF Endowed Fellowship. Other causes Kerner supported included the V Foundation for Cancer Research, Napa Valley Hospice and Adult Day Services, known now as Calabria, Napa Valley Land Trust, and the St. Helena Montessori School. So aside from his legacy in the wine industry, Kerner will also be remembered for his spirit of giving and his love of flying. There are a number of photos and miniature aircraft in his office. It seems to me that Kerner's death was unexpected, as you'll hear when I asked his son, KR, about the passing of his mother and whether Kerner was still involved with the business.
Yes, my mother, Joan Rumbauer, passed away from pancreatic cancer in December of 2002, battled that for about 3 years, which that extra time was a real gift for us. She was given about 6 weeks to live. So to have her around for 2.5, 3 years longer was very special for us. And yeah, Kerner's doing great. He'll be 84 this year and is keeping us on our toes.
By that statement, it does seem to me that Kerner's passing did come as quite a surprise. Now, I'll pick up where I left off the day of the interview. If the name Rumbauer sounds familiar to you, but not necessarily associated to wine, you may be surprised to learn that KR's great aunt Irma Rumbauer was the author of the ever-present classic cookbook, The Joy of Cooking. They had placed some copies on the luncheon table, and I couldn't believe how thick that book has become in its 80-plus years.
You know, it's affectionately known as the Kitchen Bible, and it's just in many, many people's kitchens. So while people might not always be familiar with Rum Barrel Wines, they're like, I've seen that name somewhere before. And of course, it's like, well, do you have a copy of The Joy of Cooking in your kitchen? Irma Rum Barrel wrote that. And so that's in the fourth generation's hands right now. They're working on a revision that should be out, I believe, in 2019. And, you know, there's no reason that book won't go through easily 100 years of publication.
And you're taking advantage of that because your website has a number of wine and food pairings with some of the recipes from the book.
Yeah, Irma Rumbauer's great-great-grandson, John Becker, his father, Ethan Becker, are editors of The Joy of Cooking and working with the publishing company that owns the book. And so it's very exciting to see that continue on. And hopefully provide a lot of great food and good memories for people.
Now, this is being broadcast from the Sonoma side over in Santa Rosa. So I know a number of people certainly come over here to Napa Valley. But for those who haven't been to Rumbauer yet, what would you say to entice my listeners to come over and pay a visit?
You know, there's beautiful wines throughout California and all the different regions, obviously Sonoma County, Napa County, the Central Coast, et cetera. So, you know, just take a journey over and enjoy some of the sights over here and try some of the wines.
You know, it's interesting when we were sitting in your conference room earlier, you're just off Silverado Trail. You're probably, 100 yards from the valley, if that. And all you can see out the window was pine trees.
We're on a hill sort of in the center of the valley, just off the Silverado Trail, and so you don't see us from the road, but we have some great views when you come up here, and we think some pretty lovely landscape, and so hopefully that will entice you, and the wines will make you happy.
And to end, you know, Richie in Sonoma, 2009 was a great year, too. Where were you in 2009?
2009, I was here. 2009 was my second year in charge, and it was a bit of a blur, I'm not going to lie. But 2009, yeah, 2009 Reds are definitely some of the best we've made. But yeah, it was. I just remember 2009, it was a big harvest as well. And it was just, it was mad. It was like chaos. It was like, how are we gonna get this all in? How are we going to do it? Is that tank big enough? Are you sure it's not big enough? Maybe you could squeeze a little more. And it was... You remember each vintage for different reasons. I remember 2009 just being, holy crap, it's a sink or swim moment for me. It was my second year in charge at Rumbauer, and this big harvest comes along, and I'm like, everyone kept looking at me, well, what are we going to do? You're the boss. I'm like, we'll figure it out. We'll just figure it out. Yeah. So I've done a few harvests like that around the world where they're big harvests, and it's like, sure, that tank's not big enough? Squeeze a little more in there, and... I remember one harvest in New Zealand running out of tank space, making Sauvignon Blanc in a big winery, and it was literally like go around the top of every tank and make sure every single tank was full because you had to figure out where to squeeze more juice. And yeah, it's every year is different for a reason.
After the drought years, those are good problems to have, aren't
definitely.
They? Definitely. Hey, guys, thanks for your time. Appreciate it. And what a wonderful luncheon and tasting we had today. I sure enjoyed myself.
Thank you so much. You know, just we really appreciate you taking the time to come over and drink wine, live fine.
Yes, indeed. And I'd like to take a moment again to offer my heartfelt condolences to the family following the passing of KR's father, Kerner, who spent many years, most with his wife Joan, building the Rumbauer Vineyard's legacy. To learn more about the winery and their wines, visit rumbauer.com, rumbauer.com. That wraps up this podcast. Find my past shows at onthewineroad.com and follow me on Instagram and Twitter at JDWineRoad. Hey, thanks for joining me for another venture on the Wine Road.